Accession number 28653, Mr. Francis Lucas, Reel 2. Now, once the war started, how did it affect your life in the sort of short before you joined up? I mean, you joined up in February 1940, so the sort of 5 or 6 months. How did life change for you in those months?
Life changed in the sense that the work with the Post Office Engineering Department became the absolute priority. For example, the Admiralty moved to Bath, or Judah moved to Bath, and occupy the main hotels there. And so we were transferred to the Bath area and worked almost day and night in these hotels, fitting out telephone facilities throughout all the rooms, etc. We were so much involved there that for several weeks we literally slept in the hotels, because it was an emergency situation to get the telecommunication facilities ready for the Admiralty before they moved in. And so that became our absolute priority, etc. And so there was this great change that the war made in our day-to-day working routine, etc.
Now, what sort of telephone facilities were you installing? I mean, what was, presumably...
Every desk, of course, had to have its own extension and so on, and switchboards, and they're all the old-fashioned type, had to be installed in not only each hotel. There were about five hotels they took over, but also they were divided into sections in some cases. So in one hotel there would be four or five separate switchboards manned for particular departments of the Admiralty. It was a major, absolutely major influx and so on. And then at the same time, there was development of the underground storage facilities at Corsham in the old Bath Stone Quarries. And there were extensive work carried out there.
And were you doing that as well?
Only occasionally. Occasionally I had to give some assistance with my group over there, but mainly in the Bath hotels.
Now, what were the underground... Did you get to see much of what the underground facilities
were
like?
Oh, yes, I saw it. It was is converted literally to a town underneath. The stone quarries have been worked for hundreds of years, and they were very dry, and the temperature was very, very stable, etc. And they were used, amongst other things, of course, for storing artifacts and the contents of various places like Royal Academy, all sorts of things, etc.
And how long were you doing this for, from September through to...?
September until I was called up in February. Wasn't
now, it? What was the situation about your call-up? Had you considered yourself to be a reserved occupation, or did you want to be reserved occupation, or were you just waiting to see what, as you had mentioned?
Waiting to see what happened, effectively. And so it soon became obvious that we would not be reserved, and therefore it was only a matter of waiting your call-up date.
Now, what was the procedure of call-up? How did they actually do it? And how did you end up where you did end up?
It was done by a formal official letter which came, your call-up papers. I forget the actual nature of them, but it included a formal statement that you had been called to His Majesty's Forces, blah, 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 and so on. And your details, and you had instructions to report initially for medical examination, and then finally, a couple of weeks after that, to report to your recruiting centre.
Did you have any choice in what unit you were going to join at all?
No, none whatever. Because we were from the post office engineering, they did fortunately recruit us into the Royal Corps of Signals. That was one of the sensible things that they did.
And you knew that before you were called?
Yes, you knew you were going to be in Signals. And then the great thing was the post office advised us that as far as they were concerned, we would continue our appointment with the post office, and in point of fact, that they will continue to pay the difference between our army allowance and our current salary, which was a tremendous thing. And very few had that privilege.
Now, so what happened when you were called up on the 16th of February, 1940. Now, where did you have to go? You went to Amroth, but why? Tell us about the journey to Amroth and what happened when you got there.
We were provided with train tickets, and if I remember rightly, the ticket was from Bath in Somerset, of course, to Narberth. I think that's in Pembrokeshire, was in the area of Amroth, and we had to report there to recruiting officers, and were advised they would be at a depot at the station at Narberth.
And what happened when he got there?
A very good introduction to the army at its worst. In point of fact, when we got there, there seemed to be about 30 or 40 of us arriving from everywhere and gathering there. And there was a few army personnel waiting for us. The problem was that the transport they were expecting hadn't arrived. And then after several hours, and by that time it was midnight or whatever, a couple of trucks did arrive, and Amroth, I believe, was about 20 miles from Narberth. And then after about half an hour, the truck broke down. It was almost dawn before eventually alternative transport reached us, and we got to Amroth absolutely flaked out.
Now, you'd had a bit of a... While you were in the back of the truck, you were sort of thinking about the situation you were in and about your own spiritual sort of...
Oh, indeed.
It's quite a good story. I mean, there's some notes that you're going to give us a copy
yes.
of about your... It's just sort of an account of your spiritual journey that
yes.
you went through, you know, and that will be lodged either in the file or in the Department of Documents at some point.
Yes.
But we're going to cover some elements of it. But then this
yes.
certainly is a good story. I don't know whether you still remember it. You wrote this a long
time
ago.
I do indeed. Well, as you can imagine, I had very, very definitely convictions of faith. I knew that going into the army would test my sincerity to its utmost. And during this waiting period, when we're in the back of trucks, you can imagine the sort of stories that circulated around. The sort that I would want no truck with, you know, quite frankly, filthy army stories, to put it very, very bluntly. And I kept quiet and thought to myself, my goodness, how on earth am I going to see this through? And what I realized was that the first week probably would be of vital importance, that if I didn't make my position known during that time, then I would find it difficult to make a stand. And so I prayed for strength, that I would have strength to be able to avoid the contamination, if you like, of this sort of situation. And The crisis came, the real crisis, came on the first night. And we were together, by that time, about 100 of us, in a church hall in Anroth, where there were bunks have been installed, three-tier bunks to accommodate us. And I realized that I had to make a stand at that time. And so there's one way to do it, and that was before I got in my bunk to kneel down and apparently pray. I did kneel down. I was so het up that I doubted if I prayed, but I knew I had to kneel down. And I remember now, suddenly a silence went through the place. The talking that stopped. And I realized they'd been astounded by what this particular chap had done. And I expected a few boots and whatever to come my way. Nothing did. Great. So I got up after an appropriate time and got in my bunk. During the next day, seven or eight other lads at various times came to me and said things like that. Gosh, we admire what you did. We're Christians too, but we didn't have the guts to do that. And the result was we sort of tended to band together and support one another. And that continued throughout my early army career. And one tended to gather around one those who had similar convictions, and many others who seemed to come to similar convictions. And we tried to live, you know, lives that were appropriate in the midst of a typical army situation.
Now, how did you take to it? I mean, did you find it difficult with things like the swearing? I don't know how offensive you found swearing, but there's a lot of swearing in the army. Did you find that difficult? Or
not really. Because the strange thing was, you get to the stage where, in a way, you just ignore it. It's part of the of the language, and a bit of the language you just ignored and didn't bother with. And you didn't find necessary yourself to use it, and so on.
Was there any antagonism between the religious group and the non-religious group, or was it just just basically you didn't mix with them much?
No antagonism at all. A lot of leg pulling, but nothing that was really objectionable in that sense. They were, shall I say, very. I won't say considerate towards us, but did not really make things difficult. Apart from one gentleman who obviously wanted the confrontation. That's another story.
Does that come later?
No, it is relevant to now, actually. He's a fellow named Glyn Evans. He was quite a big chap. He was foul-mouthed, and very few people liked him. He was always controversial, etc. And I knew that he was going to make a set at me, and I felt I had to bring it to a head. And so in the canteen one night, I took my Bible into the canteen. I sat down with a cup of tea, coffee, what have you, at the table, and I opened my Bible before me. Glyn was in the room, and it wasn't long before, in his wandering around, he spotted me. He came over, and I can sense now his presence behind me. He just stood behind me, and then suddenly bellowed, "What are you doing there reading that?" So I just replied, "The Bible. Why are you doing that?" And so there's this sort of exchange. And then suddenly I got my strength together. I forget what I said, but I turned round on him and I roundly, absolutely ground him in the dust with what I said. Everyone else in the canteen, I remember, were just fixed on this. And in the end, he just shut up and he just quietly walked away. And he's never a problem after that. I knew there had to be a confrontation. One or two had said to me afterwards, quite good for you, that kind of thing.
Now, let's go move on to the actual conditions. Where were you actually living? What sort of billets were you in?
In Amroth, we were billeted out. And there were a number of houses along the front, in particular, that had spare accommodation or were vacant, and a house that three friends and myself were allocated to was on the seafront, and a place called Venture, that was the name of the house, because we saw a parody there and said, my goodness, this is a venture, and that's on. And so the accommodation there was very rough. It was a cold winter. The owner or occupier of the house was an old fellow, and what he did, he would put out a couple of buckets of lukewarm water in the yard outside, and we had to shave and wash ourselves in this cold, freezing winter in those buckets. He was really unnecessarily tough and brutal. But there we are. The fact that several of you together, you see, you tend to make fun of it, and you do get through.
Now, what was a typical day's training like for you? Because this is presumably your basic training, where you're actually learning to be a soldier.
That's right.
Rather than learning to be a signaller.
Yes.
How would the day start? I mean, you presumably wake up at Venture then, you know.
Yes. Well, technically, nothing happened. It was basic army training. And the majority of the day was spent in marching, in rifle drill. And I remember the seafront road. We would march up and down there.
Now, how did you take to drill, foot drill? Because some people have trouble with it, others don't. You've never done anything like that, I presume?
Oh, not brilliant. But one just managed to get away with it sufficiently well. And that was typical. We were probably initially a sloppy lot. But quite frankly, in the end, I really think we smartened up quite considerably.
Did you see the point of drill, ordinary foot drill, up and down, at the time?
We didn't see any point to it. We just did it. Simply because that's what it required to do, what you had to do, and you get shouted at if you didn't. And we just shrugged our shoulders. Don't think we saw any particular point in it. Apart from what else would you do if you were not doing that? There didn't seem to be anything else to do anyway.
Now, what about weapons training? Let's start with the rifle. Firstly, did you have any qualms about learning how to use a Lee Enfield rifle, in the sense of it is a killing machine?
None whatever. Strangely enough, that did not become an issue. Illogical and inconsistent, I know, but it wasn't an issue.
Now, and tell me, how did they train you to shoot? And what was the process of you know, the way they took you through the training?
In a very simple way. First of all, the right way, I remember, to handle the short Lee Enfield for the various drill movements. They kept on at that to the point of exhaustion and so on. And so you got to know thoroughly how to handle the thing, how to spring to attention and shoulder arms and all the other routines. And then there were sessions in which you were shown how to strip the thing down and to clean it, etc. And then that went on to the Bren gun, I think just shortly.
I'll come back to the bread. Did you actually get to fire the rifle? Either .22 or on a range, proper range?
No, not at that stage. This is simply straightforward drill without any actual firing.
And the Bren, were you learning to strip... Sorry, I interrupted. And the Bren...
That's right. The Bren gun, of course, we learned to strip that down, and some of the lads were getting a mess with it. I was fortunate because... I was just handy at mechanical things.
Was it literally this business of stripping it down blindfold, I mean, or in the dark? I mean, did you actually go as far as that, or was it just...
No, not in the dark. No, it was all just, fortunately, fairly normal, straightforward.
What other weapons were you introduced to?
Just those two, no others. And of course, they didn't have the facilities there.
So no grenades or anything
down there in Amroth.
Bayonet. No. Bayonet training.
No, we didn't.
So what other types of training were you doing at Amroth in this basic training course?
Effectively, nothing I can remember. Strangely enough, apart from drill, of course, and apart from. The proper acknowledgement of an officer, etc., knowing when to stand at attention and so on. No, it was very, very basic. I would say the main thing it did was to help us to be able to know how to live together. That fundamentally would be a thing that you did come to terms with, to live with. And it was, for a lifetime, very useful there. Just how to live together.
What about your instructors? What was your? How did you get on with them? What did you think of them? Were they the cruder type, or were they sympathetic?
No, they were pretty rough, pretty crude, and with the greatest of respect, I would say not over-intelligent. That's the greatest respect. But the interesting thing was there were groups that began to get together. For example, you would have several lads who were interested in photography, for example, and in other pursuits. And lads with hobbies tended to group together and so on. And deep and close friendships were, I know, established there. And the fact you had this rough treatment didn't seem to matter very much. That's strange. So you did live, you did get to know how to live together.
Now, what about the your church interests? I mean, did you manage to... you seem to... I'm just having a look at your notes. You seem to have managed to set up a sort of religious group.
Yes.
I don't know whether it's that formal, but is it Ebenezer Welsh Baptist Church?
That's right. Well, you see, we did have the obligatory church parades.
Now, tell me what you thought of the church parades. I mean, as an act of worship, as a serious act of worship, or...
As a serious act of worship, the church parades... I felt were well worthwhile, and strangely enough, they were not deprecated as much as you would imagine. Part of the reason, I think, was the fact it was the relief of a different routine. I'm sure that was it. But with a few colleagues, we tended to go that little stage further and so on. And the church parade was held in this little Amroth church on the Sunday morning. But then the group has got together and thought, that's fine, we need something extra, both personally and to establish our position. And so we would attend the evening service in the church, but there was no service happening in the afternoon, as was often the case in those days in the small nonconformist churches, there'd usually be some form of service there. And so what I decided was to get together the group of our like-thinking lads and arrange something for ourselves in the afternoon. And this is absolutely factual. It's not stretched in any way. Easter was coming up, and I thought, right, now this is the opportunity to hold something special. And so I approached the secretary of the church and said, would it be possible for us viewers to use their church on a Sunday afternoon? I wanted to arrange a little service for ourselves as it was Easter. He said, yes, no problem at all. Do you want a pianist or organist? We said, yes, great. Well, in that case, our organist, a young girl, she'll come and play for you. And so we had this little service. And there were only about, in the event, although we publicized it around everyone, I think there's probably about a dozen of us who got there. This girl, the organist, when we were about to start the service, she suddenly ran out. Thought, what on earth's happening? A few minutes later, she came back with obviously several members of her family. And the result was that following that, we used it every Sunday afternoon, and more people from the local village came in. And so it ended up with a combined service of our army lads and local people. It was just fantastic. And we were thrilled, of course. And, of course, that also resulted in many invitations out to tea, meals and supper with local folk, and we got to know them very well indeed.
You also formed a choir, I think. I don't know whether you formed it or whether you encouraged it.
Yes. There are many Welsh lads in our group. And, of course, the Welsh lads love to sing. And so they came along in due course and formed a choir. Whether they're in sympathy with our faith outlook was wholly irrelevant. They loved to sing. They came along, and we had great times with them.
So, anything else?
It was a very rich time there, you know.
Now, how long were you at Amroth?
I'm not quite certain about times and dates. I'm thinking of a guess. About 4 or 5 months, I suppose.
So till summer, till June?
That's right, yes. Yes, it would be.
And if we say approximately, then yes, that covers it a bit. Now, where were we to move then?
Now, from Amroth, we were suddenly posted to Northern Ireland.
Now, who are you joining in Northern Ireland? I mean, what was the name of the unit?
I'm not quite sure at what stage. It was the 53rd Welsh Division that we were assimilated into, the 53rd Welsh.
And that was who was going to train you?
That was for further training in Northern Ireland, indeed.
And whereabouts? To Belfast?
To Belfast, yes. Mm.
And you with the Royal Corps of Signals?
I was by that time, of course, recruited into the signals.
And did they have a particular company or name, or do you not, of the Royal Corps that you were in?
No, just that time, the signals. I think we regard ourselves still at that stage in the 53rd Welsh Division, but in the signals section.
And What about your trip over there? Do you remember your trip to Belfast?
Yes, I remember it very well indeed.
It says it was a distressing
trip. It was indeed. Normally, it's a rough passage going across. There's a bit of a gale, and the whole lot of us were sick and seasick and in a shocking state when eventually we got into the harbour at Belfast. It was a most distressing sea trip, I remember.